Are our guests, Ms. Vizcarra and Dr. Gurotian, here? Yes. You're here?
Can you raise your hand, please?
Yeah, could you come up? And could you tell me, please, how I massacred your name?
Actually, you got it right. I'm one of the only people who's ever gotten it correct.
Paratian?
Paratian.
Hey. You know, as an English teacher, I always really worked hard to get my students' names. And is Diana with you?
I haven't. Sure.
Is Diana with you?
No, I haven't seen her. She's supposed to be here.
Okay. Looks like you're going to have to. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this next presentation is so, it's going to be so interesting. It's advanced. Doctor, we're going to have to wait a minute.
Okay.
They want a door prize. Let's have a door prize. Let's have a door prize. Rosh, are you prepared to do that? So where's the box? This is the first time our volunteers have sort of had to do this, and they told me we were ready. The door prize box, the box of names, and what door prize are we going to give out first? Oh, you have to go get it? You have to go, okay, wait a minute, we're going to do it, I promise, right after this presentation. She's got to go get stuff. I thought it was in the room. Okay, so, advancing toward a brain stimulator to restore vision. And isn't that just, oh my goodness. So Diana Vizcarra has been working as a single case study directed by Dr. Nader Gurotian from the University of California, UCLA, at Los Angeles. And we welcome Dr. Gurotian today. And if Ms. Vizcarra shows up, we'll welcome her too. Doctor, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much for the invitation. As she mentioned, my name is Nader Paradian, and I'm a neurosurgeon. And I'll tell you about what I do as a neurosurgeon. I'm what we call a functional neurosurgeon, which makes all my colleagues dysfunctional. But what it means is that the surgeries that I do focus on restoring function or improving the function of the patients that I operate on. So everyone thinks about brain surgery and they think of brain tumors and aneurysms and brain trauma, which are things that I deal with a little bit, but the primary focus of my clinical work is on using brain stimulators for patients with Parkinson's disease, because that's where we have the most knowledge and the most effective treatments. The brain stimulators that we use are like cardiac pacemakers, so like people who have abnormal rhythms of their heart, and they have a stimulator that goes to their heart to keep a normal rhythm. Instead, we place these stimulators that are designed for the brain into specific parts of the brain to restore a more normal pattern of activity for patients with Parkinson's disease. And there's actually FDA approval also for essential tremor, which is a different type of movement disorder, dystonia, which is yet another type of movement disorder, and of all things, the fourth indication that's been approved by the FDA is obsessive compulsive disorder, which we don't do too much of, but that is approved. That's what I do. The goals in these surgeries are to try and make people function a little bit better. And I do research as well. I work at a university, and a lot of my research has to do with trying to understand how brain stimulation can be used to improve that function, understanding how it works in Parkinson's disease, but also applying it to other diseases. And one day I was sitting in my office and I got a call from an old colleague of mine. So in addition to going to medical school, I did a PhD. And someone from my PhD class gave me a call and she said, you know, I'm working at a company called Second Sight. Has anyone here heard of Second Sight? Okay, great. So Second Sight is the company behind all this. And as you know, they've worked on the retinal prosthesis, and that has FDA approval for...
Could we have silence, please?
Has FDA approval for a specific indication. But they called and they said, you know, we've figured out the retinal prosthesis, and obviously they're still working on improving that, but we're interested in looking at the brain. And can we stimulate the brain to restore vision for people who might not be candidates for retinal prostheses? And it was really exciting, because no one in neurosurgery is really thinking about this, although there has been a little bit of work, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But I said, you know, that would be great. And so a little bit of a personal touch. That was before I had my third child, and my third child, we discovered at the age of 6 months, has ocular albinism, oculocutaneous albinism, and he's doing quite well, but it gave me all the more motivation to work on something for those with poor vision or no vision. So the work has come a long way, and what we've done is, with Second Sight, adapted the technology that they had for the retinal prosthesis, but it's designed so that instead of delivering stimulation to the retina now, it delivers stimulation to the brain, and it requires brain surgery. There's a lot of work that goes into figuring out how to design a new brain stimulator. We spent a long time in the laboratory with cadavers, trying to figure out the right design, getting it to fit correctly. We've done extensive animal studies to assess, you know, how biocompatible the device is, how well the brain tolerates this kind of device. But the one piece of information we didn't really have was, how well is this going to work? You know, after we put a device in, what kind of vision can we get, or what kind of visual perceptions can we get? How consistent is it? How well tolerated is it? What are the side effects of this type of stimulation? And so we looked back at the history a little bit, and there's two researchers, Dobell and Brindley, who've done this type of work in the past and done brain stimulators, but where the electrodes actually stuck out of the head, and so there were wires coming out of people's heads, and they lived like that for a long time. But a lot of that work was unfortunately lost as the investigators actually passed away unexpectedly, and the research just completely stopped, and no one has really revisited it. And so what we did is, there are other brain stimulators on the market also, besides deep brain stimulators, and we decided that the best way to learn is to actually try this on a volunteer. And it was there's another device that's used for epilepsy, for stimulating the brain for patients with epilepsy to try and control epilepsy. It's already FDA approved. And we decided that we would try to implant this device over the parts of the brain that are involved in human vision, what we call the primary visual cortex, and see what we could get. So this was a pure science experiment. We didn't have a device that actually has a camera or can sense the world or can stimulate the brain based on what it sees through the camera, but we wanted to see if we could stimulate the brain in a consistent manner and have someone see something in it in a very reliable way. And I see Diana in the back, so she'll come up, and I'm just about to start talking about her. So we decided we were going to implant up to 5 subjects, and a little bit about Diana. Do you want to come to the front?
Bring her. Come on up.
And we looked long and hard, because it's not something that everyone or anyone wanted to really. Actually, we had a lot of people who wanted to do it, but we needed to find the right person to do this, because there was no therapeutic intent here. We weren't trying to do this to give vision back in this first scenario. What we were trying to do was understand how well we can stimulate the brain. And I think Diana was one of the first people I spoke to, and for whatever reason, and I can't remember, and clearly I was wrong, I disqualified her. And She wrote to me about 6 weeks afterwards and said, "You're wrong, I'm the right person, and you're going to operate on me." And so, and that's what we did. So she underwent a surgery that was about 5 or 6 hours long. And I'm going to let her tell you about why she did it, but we implanted a device. The electrodes are inside of her brain, on top of her brain, on the inside, and the device is implanted in her skull, and it's completely under the skin. We can communicate with it with a wand, basically, that communicates through the skin, and she has selflessly been coming to UCLA once a week since her implant about 8 months ago, where we turn the device on and we do all kinds of manipulations to answer the questions that we need to know to be able to go through our next step of doing a true clinical trial with the device that's approved. So I'm going to take a little break and let Diana speak a little bit about her experience, you know, why she did this and what brought her to this point and how the clinical trial has been affecting her.
Hello, everyone. Sorry I'm late. Had to drive from Orange County.
I told you she's selfless.
My name is Diana Viscara. I'm 31 years old. I'm going to give a little bit of my history, why, you know, how I lost my vision, so everyone has a little understanding about that. When I was 21, I was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune, Voigt-Koyanagi-Harada syndrome. There's a lot of adverse side effects with that autoimmune. And 1.5 years after I was diagnosed, I woke up. I had suffered closure angle glaucoma, which pretty much took my vision overnight. And that was the day I realized that, okay, we can't always prepare for everything. Things happen suddenly, and I had to adapt to that. Ever since then, I've had multiple surgeries. I've done many things. I've been very proactive. I've changed my diet, just hoping that I would get my vision back. And I think many can relate to that. Then about a year ago, this time, one of my fiance's friends sent me a number. He didn't tell me what it was for. He just said, "Call this number. It's going to help you." So I called, and I remember the lady said, "What's the reason for your call?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm blind. All I know is that I'm supposed to call this number." And she put me on hold, and she said, "Let me figure that out because we have a lot of case studies going on." And then I left my information, and Dr. Paradian called me 2 days later, and he told you the story that he declined me, and I was like, no! I'm like, how am I going to convince a UCLA neurologist? But we all know the results of that. And since then, I went through the surgery. I mean, before the surgery, there was things that had to be done to pre-qualify me. I had to see a psychologist, right? I had to do a neurocognitive test and MRI and a couple other tests. And then right after that, I was in the hospital ready for surgery. And I remember the day that I was at the hospital, I was laying in bed, or on the hospital bed, and the anesthesiologist was preparing the needle, the IV, and a nurse came in, and the nurse said, "Well, are we shaving all of your hair or half of your hair?" And for I have very thick hair, and it's all the way down to my belly button, so you all may think like, okay, how are you going to tell me this right before surgery? And my fiance was the one that was panicking, and then the anesthesiologist started giving me this stuff that was making me feel good. So at that point, I'm like, I don't really care. I feel good. It doesn't really matter at this point. And my fiance's like, "What? What do you mean?" I'm like, "The new styles, being like having no hair, it's okay. Women are shaving their hair off, so it's okay." And he's like, no, it's not okay. So then we did the surgery. I woke up, and it wasn't as bad as I thought. I really thought that I was going to feel ill, but I didn't. I just woke up, easy transition. I had like a wrapping over my head, so I wasn't able to touch anything, but I did feel two pigtails coming out in the bottom. I said, okay, my hair's still intact. And yeah, it was 2.5 days in the hospital. Obviously, the medication was more of the irritation. I don't, being blind, I rely on my senses. So if you take any type of painkiller, it doesn't really go well with trying to focus on sounds and what's going on in your environment. So I think that was the most difficult part. And then we took off the dressing, the wrapping, and the stitches came out. It was an incision on the back right of my head. Dr. Pradian did an excellent job, only shaving like a little thin area. So you can't even notice it, which I was really happy about. Then we started the therapy sessions, which was, I don't think anyone no one knew what exactly was going to happen. So that was a little frightening. And we started the sessions. And the first day, I saw multiple colors. And then I started seeing shapes, circles and lines. And then I was already ready to, like, ramp it up. Everyone's like, no, we have to take steps. I'm like, no, turn all of them on. I want to see more of this. We did it slowly, week after week. We went through different settings. It's really important to gather information, understand what I've been told. It's crucial to understand how the visual cortex works and how the device is working with the visual cortex. The only bad experience I had in one of the sessions was when the duration of the stimulation, think about like seconds or less than a second. So one day someone thought, okay, let's do it for 10 seconds. Let's see what happens. And I felt like I was on drugs. Like everything was just moving around and I couldn't figure out if I was standing or if I was on the roof. I was all over the place. And then they're like, okay, I think we took too many steps forward. Let's go back. They started working on different settings, and I'm just ready for the next device. I think we've done a lot of research for this, and now the reason why I thought about this question. I'm like, okay, I know I'm a daredevil, and I tend to put myself in situations that later I regret. But I thought about this question: why did I do this? And the day that I thought about this, I was on YouTube and I heard about the story of, I think it's Louis Braille. I may not be saying his first name right, but the man who created the, and he, I heard his story for the first time. I never knew exactly anything about him. And it, you know, he was 3 when he lost his vision. Then he ended up going to a blind school for the first time. And his expectations were to learn how to read and write. And nothing was there for him. They were, on the contrary, they had them, all the blind people, working in a factory. And so he was dedicated to create something. And he did. I mean, we all know what he created. And it's been impactful. And he died about a year after his creation. And for me, I think that I believe that we're at the right time of something powerful that can help the blind see again and for others see for the first time. And I think that sometimes we think of our destination instead of the journey, and it's more about the journey, not about the destination. And if there's something that I can do that I believe will eventually help others, not only here, but in other countries where they don't have programs like we do and organizations that represent us, then I did my part. Even if it's something I'm not going to be able to cherish. Just like Louis, he never was able to cherish his creation. And I think that life is about that. It's about doing as much as you can to give back, knowing that it's going to have a ripple effect. So that's the reason.
Can I add just two more?
Certainly, and then I'm sure we're going to have several questions.
So. Just 2 minutes. So just two more minutes of comments, and we'll take questions. Just an observation about the first time we turned on Diana's simulator, there were a lot of people in the room because we were all very excited. And we were excited, you know, there's eight stimulators or eight contacts on her brain, and we were extremely excited that all eight produced some kind of visual perception, which we weren't sure what we were going to get. The other very interesting thing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Diana, most of what she sees is black and white or shades of gray, except for some things that are color. And I think the color was particularly emotionally stimulating or evoked a lot of emotions because it had a lot more meaning than just black or white. And, you know, the difficult thing that, I'm going to take the words from your mouth, was I think it was a little bit jarring at first, right? Because it was the first time you'd seen something like that in, you know, 10 years or so, 9 or 10 years. And I remember you saying that the thing that you feared most was that you have something back and that you would lose it again. And so I think, you know, comments like that are really what motivate us to keep going forward to do this type of research. A couple things about where we're headed with all this. Who is a candidate for this type of work? It's people with no or bare light perception. So people who can still see or make things out with some kind of enhancement, unfortunately, are not the type of people that we're at least initially targeting with this type of therapy because we're superimposing a new perception on top of what your eyes may already be delivering to your brain. The other thing is, we've had a lot of conversations on the backside between myself and Second Sight in terms of what our goals are. And the goals are not really to restore vision the way that a normally sighted person might see things. But if we can restore something to the extent that people can perceive, for example, doorways or walkways or faces or people walking towards them or edges, even that we feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, would restore some level of independence or sense of functionality to patients like you who are blind, and we think that's going to be worthwhile. It's a big, big challenge ahead of us to figure out how to stimulate to make this all meaningful, but that's the challenge that we've accepted and we're moving forward with.
Wonderful. Okay, let's have some questions. Don't all stand up at once. Steve, I hear you.
Okay. Hi, this is a question.
Wait a minute, Dave. Steve was first.
This is right here. There's a lot of questions. 15.
And then David, and then...
Dr. Pradyan and Diana, thank you very much. This is certainly very exciting. I'm curious, though, to ask, even among those who have the very, very limited degree of vision that you suggest or no vision at all, there are many different causes of their blindness. And I'm wondering from the diagnostic standpoint, which of the more prevalent causes do you expect would be particularly responsive to brain stimulation as a technique for restoring some residual vision, and which, because they involve issues of the lens of the eye, the optic nerve, et cetera, might not respond so well to brain stimulation?
This is a good question. The people who will respond, or the criteria for the trial, once the trial goes live, is going to be people who are previously sighted, because your brain needs to have seen something to be able to develop properly to process visual input. So being previously sighted is important. The cause of blindness also has to be non-cortical or non-brain-based. So it has to be something in the optic nerves, chiasm, tract, or in front of that, so retina, globe, lens, cataract, or whatever, what have you, anything anterior or before the brain. The only exclusion criteria is if you are a candidate for a retinal prosthesis, then you should have the retinal prosthesis because that's probably going to be more effective than a brain stimulator.
David, you were next.
So this is a question for the doctor. So we're talking about stimulating the visual cortex. So how far can the technology go? I guess what you're saying is that you're still putting something fairly large on top of the brain. How much smaller will that technology have to be in order for the stimulation to really be activated?
So there's different strategies about how to do this. And again, with Second Sight, we've gone through all these different strategies. In terms of the implant that goes on the brain, I don't think we're going to get smaller than what we have right now because we want that coverage over the brain. There's another strategy from another group in Chicago that wants to put multiple, what we call penetrating arrays throughout the visual cortices, which would be smaller, but entering into the brain as opposed to what we're doing, which is placing it on top of the brain. So I actually think what Second Sight has designed and is planning to use in trials is pretty slick. So I don't think it's going to be miniaturized too much smaller. It's pretty small as it is.
Somebody else has a question?
Hello,
I'm Mary Lou Baracco from Chatsworth, Ohio, California. I have a question for the doctor. If a patient needs to have an MRI or a CT scan, can they have one? Or that's not going to work because these implants?
So the device that has been designed, that is, again, not yet in clinical trials, is designed to be MRI compatible, but it will not have MR compatibility labeling by the FDA when it initially undergoes trials. So officially, you cannot have an MRI once you're implanted, but you can have a CT scan. The thought is once things get approved and it gets along, then they'll do testing to prove the MR compatibility so you can actually get an MRI with it in your head.
We can't take all the questions, but we can take a couple more.
Hi, this is Sarah Harris. How would someone contact you to possibly one day be part of this clinical trial?
Good question. So I knew I was going to forget it, but I'm very findable on the UCLA website. If you go to UCLA Neurosurgery, I'm listed there and my email is there. So I get emails now two or three times a week from people around the country and around the world asking to participate in the trial. So there's been a little bit of press coverage, so people are out there contacting me.
Who's got the mic?
There's three more, one back there.
I think we can take those three.
Karen Memmer here. When I hear neurology, I think of mitochondrial disease. When I hear of autoimmune disease and glaucoma, I don't relate them. I never heard of glaucoma being caused by an autoimmune disease. Can you explain how this happened? And is there a concern for her immune system to attack what you've put into her?
It's a good question. So autoimmune disease, and I don't know all the answers because I'm not
steroids that cause the glaucoma.
Well, why don't you answer it since you know your history much better than that.
Well, the first part, the VKH caused irritation and inflammation in my eyes, and I was given a high dose of prednisone, 60 milligrams in combination with Celcept, which is an autoimmune suppressant. And I never suffered with pressure in my eyes, but somehow the prednisone the side effect of prednisone is glaucoma. So the medication that I was given to tackle the inflammation in my eyes caused me to lose my vision, I guess. I'm not sure what that is.
Stephen Johnson's is it's different. That's a drug reaction. Stephen Johnson is a drug reaction.
Okay, let's. There were a couple of other questions.
We. Okay.
Hello, Dr. Pirotian. First, I have to ask you on behalf of my wife, my partner right here, Bernice Kandarian, whether you're Armenian.
No.
But
Persian.
What I really am interested in is, you know, you always guys always talk about having had to see before, and that's probably has some value, but I think it's overrated. And I'd like to recommend that you consider at some point using bilaterally nucleated retinoblastoma people who have. You know, they're very smart. You may have heard that. I'm not one, by the way, but I have a lot of good friends.
So is the question, have I heard of bilateral retinoblastomas?
What do you think about them as being possible candidates?
Usually, it depends on what age it occurs at. And there's even something called trilateral retinoblastomas. If the reason why you need to be previously sighted, I'll give you a little bit of a science lesson. That we learned from cats long before I entered the world of science. You need to be exposed to the visual world for the brain to develop visually. And we know that because they took cats and they put them from birth in a room that only had vertical lines. And it turns out they only learned to see vertical lines. They would put them on tables and they'd walk off the edge of the table because they never learned to perceive the horizontal. So we know that our vision, our brain, only develops in response to the visual stimulation that comes through our optic nerve. So if you're never sighted, the brain will not have developed vision, and so we don't think we're going to be able to stimulate the brain to evoke a visual perception. At least that's where we're starting. You know, in device development, we need to go for where the most likely path to getting a successful outcome. And then once we're successful with that, we might be able to branch out and address other diseases as well.
I think this next is going to have to be the last question.
Sorry.
Thank you. My name is Charles Navarrete, and I contracted VKH in 1965. And even though I had the same type of treatment as Ms. Mascara, eventually the inflammation essentially destroyed my retina and my optic nerve. So I don't understand how the things you're doing could help someone like me, since there's no way to send the signals from my eyes to the brain.
So that's a good question, just to finish to make sure everyone understand what happens. So normally, to see, light has to go through the cornea, through the lens, to the back of the globe, to the retina, and then the retina converts those signals that get transmitted through the optic nerve, through the thalamus, and then from the thalamus back to the cortex. What we are doing with brain stimulation is bypassing all of that and saying, you know, if you can't get vision back to the brain through that entire pathway, we're completely going to bypass it and send the signals directly to the brain through this stimulator. So the entire device, just to be clear, has glasses that have a video camera on it. The video camera connects to what they call a video processing unit. The video processing unit then transmits signals to the brain stimulator to directly stimulate the brain. So your eyes never have to see anything. Your optic nerves never need to transmit any signals. Your thalamus, which is another part of the brain, never has to convert those signals to send new signals to the back of the brain. We are completely bypassing all of the optic pathway and going directly to the brain. That's the real innovation. Absolutely, yes. So we think that part of the patient population we're going to be treating could be For example, patients with trauma who've lost eyes due to trauma and who might have had reconstructive surgery and prostheses, and you might have prostheses for other reasons as well.
We have to stop the questions at this point. It's so tempting to. We can go on for another hour, but we're going to have to stop now. And we want to thank you so much. But before you leave, Doctor, I want you to come over and take a name out of this box. We are going to have a door prize. The first door prize is a basket that's got blue diamond. Jeff and Leslie Tom donated this. So, could you read the name, Doctor?
Eugene Lozano Jr.
Is Gene in the room? Hey, we can. Roche,
all right,
can
I'm
you take,
coming.
Okay, we'll get it to you, Gene. Okay, now we have 25 buckaroos from Bayview Chapter, and Diana, I'm going to send this over to you and let you pick, and I'm going to smash you in the face. I'm afraid. Reach in there and pick out a name.
Charles Navarrete.
He just asked a question. Yep, and the 25 bucks is for Charles Navarrete. Charles, raise your hand.
I'll be right there in a minute.
Okay.